जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी। जय गोपी जन वल्लभ गिरिवर धारी। जसोदाय नंदन व्रज जन रंजन जामुन चिरावन जय राधा कुंज बिहारी। जय राधा माधव कुंज बिहारी।
Shripad Paramahamsa Parivraj Gacharya Shutura Shutashi Shimana Sivangresh Shila Paripari Ki Grantaraj Shima Bhagavatam Ki Gaur Primanandi. All glories to the Assembled Devotees. All glories to Shri Shri Guru and Gauranga. Om Aknana Tminandasya Knananjana Shalakaya Chakshuru Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhushtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupakada Mayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vanchakal Puturuvyascha Kripa Sandubhyarevacha Patita Nam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha. Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadarha Srivasari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. O Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Krishna. Santa Saras Surubale Nagrahita Arto. Drishtva Gharut Matiharim Ka Upata Chakram. Udkripya sambhujakaram giramaha kritran narayanakilo guru bhagavan namaste Harish. Sarasurubhale nagrahita arto Krishna Drishtva gurut matiharim ka upata chakram Ukshipya sambhujakaram giramaha kritran Narayana Kila Guru Bhagavan Namaste. Santa Sarasurubhale Nagrahita Arto. Drishtam Gurutmati Hrinka Upata Chakram. Sambhujakaram giramaha kritchan Narayana kila guru bhagavan namaste. others. Anyone?
Tasra surupalena grihita arto. Drushpa varutmatiranam kaupata chakram. Kripya sambuja karam giramaha kricham. Narara nakila guru bhagavan namaste.
Saha. He, Gajendra, Antasarasi, and the water, Urubalena, with great force, Grihita, who have been captured by the crocodile, Arutaha, and severely suffering, Drishtra, upon seeing, Garutmati, on the back of Garuda, Haram, the Lord, Ke, in the sky, Upata Chakram, wielding his disc, Ukshipya, raising, Sa Ambujakaram, his trunk, along with the lotus flower, Giramaha, uttered the words, Kritrat, with great difficulty, because of his precarious position. Narayana, O my Lord Narayana, Akila Guru, O Universal Lord, Bhagavan, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, Namaste, Us Namaste. I offer my respectful obeisances unto you. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation. Gajendra had been forcefully captured by the crocodile in the water and was feeling acute pain. But when he saw that Narayana, wielding his disc, was coming in the sky on the back of Garuda, he immediately took a lotus flower in his trunk, and with great difficulty, due to his painful condition, he uttered the following words, quote, O my Lord Narayana, Master of the Universe, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisances unto you, end quote. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The king of the elephants was so very eager to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead that when he saw the Lord coming in the sky with great pain and in a feeble voice, he offered respect to the Lord. A devotee does not consider a dangerous position to be dangerous, for in such a dangerous position, he can fervently pray to the Lord in great ecstasy, or at least pray for us. Thus, a devotee regards danger as a good opportunity. Tate anukampam sukshamikshamanaha. When a devotee is in great danger, he sees that danger to be the great mercy of the Lord, because it is an opportunity to think of the Lord very sincerely and with undiverted attention. Tate nukampam sukshamikshamano bhunjana evatma kritam vipakam. 10th canto, chapter 14, verse 8. He does not accuse the Supreme Personality of Godhead for having let his devotee fall into such a dangerous condition. Rather, he considers that dangerous condition to be due to his past misdeeds and takes it as an opportunity to pray to the Lord and offer thanks for having been given such an opportunity. When a devotee lives in this way, his salvation, his going back home, back to Godhead, is guaranteed. We can see this to be true from the example of Gajendra, who anxiously prayed to the Lord and thus received an immediate chance to return home back to Godhead. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. So in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that there are four types of persons that come to him. Chatur Vidabhajante Mam, Janasu Kritino Arjuna, four types of pious persons that come to him. Not everyone comes to Krishna when they're suffering, but four types of pious persons. The first category is artaha, which means suffering. So that word is also used here, grihita artaha. When there's suffering, someone becomes inspired to approach the Supreme Lord. And that someone means a pious person, sukritina. They become inspired to approach the Lord. I often like to joke when I quote this verse that there are four types that come to the Lord. The distressed, the more distressed, the most distressed, and the superlatively distressed. And Kali Yuga, that is, at least. Hardly anyone comes to the Lord for money these days. Why, when you can get a job? So these are the four types of persons that come to the Lord. And the example that is given for Artha, or suffering, is Gajendra. So his initial inspiration to approach the Lord was his suffering condition. Of course, as you read through the prayers, it seems that he went a change of heart in the process of offering his prayers. But his initial motivation was his suffering condition. Now, in this particular verse is being mentioned that the Supreme Lord appears on the scene. And even though he was in a greatly difficult situation, he begins to offer a lotus flower to the Lord, feebly, because it was very difficult. He was suffering. Just like sometimes when you're suffering, when there's lamentation sitting in the mind, oftentimes the first inspiration is not to go and approach the Lord. Usually the first inspiration is to sleep, and if you wake up, to sleep more. Or for some people, it's like eat ice cream, or you know, take shelter of these sorts of things, or movies. Generally, when lamentation sits in the mind, the senses become really hard to control. And your absorption in matter becomes more comprehensive after that. Therefore, as an aside point, in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, it is mentioned that one should not allow lamentation to sit in the mind. And this is considered an anga of bhakti. I always used to get very bewildered about that because I'm like, how do you control that? When you're in a suffering condition, like some of you may have experience of breaking up with your girlfriend or boyfriend. This is for the young Westerners. And for maybe the Indians, your parents won't allow you to do something that you really want to do. I don't know. We have our different things in life that causes the severe lamentation to sit in the mind. You have some experience like this, where lamentation is sitting in the mind? And then when the lamentation sits there, your senses become really out of control, and your absorption in matter becomes more complete. Therefore, it's considered an anga of bhakti to not allow lamentation to sit in the mind, which is a very difficult thing to do. It's considered one of the first 20 essential principles to be followed in bhakti yoga. So anyway, the point is that when there's lamentation due to some suffering condition, the first inspiration isn't always to approach the Lord. Usually the first inspiration is to do more sense gratification, and usually of an unrefined sort of type, like just watch movies all day, or sleep all day, or eat ice cream and cookies, and you know, you go to the store and buy like Cookie Crisp. You have this experience when you're lamenting? That is the nature of lamentation. It's very dangerous, actually. And in a lot of ways, the whole Bhagavad Gita is about overcoming lamentation. The battlefield of Kurukshetra itself represents lamentation, because what is a battlefield? It is a place of loss. And what follows loss is lamentation. And Krishna begins his instructions by chastising Arjuna for his lamentation. And he ends Bhagavad Gita by saying, don't lament, mashuchaha. So it's kind of interesting, this theme of lamentation is a prominent one even in the Bhagavad Gita, because lamentation basically is the pervasive psychology of all conditioned souls, because we're attached to the ephemeral. So proportion in our attachment to the temporary, to that degree we suffer lamentation. And so everyone is in this world suffering some form of lamentation, more or less, proportionate their attachment to the temporary. So lamentation is a really hard thing to overcome. And when it's there in the mind, the inspiration isn't always to approach the Supreme Lord for relief. Here we see that Gajendra is doing that. He's approaching the Supreme Lord, even though his condition is so severe and actually physically challenging to approach the Lord, still he is approaching the Lord. Just like sometimes, this is just I guess it's kind of meant to be a joke. Srila Prabhupada once told that everyone should always go to the Mangalarti. It seems he has told this. And if you are too sick to go to the Mangalarti, then you should crawl to the Mangalarti. Like if you were too sick to walk to it, then you should crawl to the Mangalarti. I remember never appreciating this. I've heard several devotees mention this point in class all over the world. And every time I hear it, I never appreciate it. I'm like, nah. If I'm too sick, I'm going to take good rest, probably for a few days. So that is a tendency of conditional, especially when you're physically compromised. Your inspiration is not usually the Supreme Lord. Gajendra is physically compromised. Still, he is trying to offer a lotus flower to the Supreme Lord. So he sees the Lord coming on the back of Garuda in the sky, holding his chakra. And he begins with great difficulty to offer this lotus flower, along with some nice words. O Lord Narayana, O Lord of the universe, O Bhagavan, my obeisances unto you. So although his initial inspiration for approaching the Supreme Lord is suffering, it does appear that he's undergone a transformation, because in this purport, Prabhupada is describing the mentality of a devotee in general. And by dint of context, it seems to be describing the mentality of Gajendra in this particular verse. And the direction Prabhupada takes here in the purport is that dangers or a dangerous situation is for a devotee a very wonderful opportunity. So this, of course, reminds one of the Queen Kunti's verse, Vipada santu tashashrat tatra tatra jagaguro bhagato dharshanam yasara punabhavadarshanam. So she prays to the Supreme Lord. It's a section of her prayers where she's offering a submission of her consciousness. This word submission, you should be submissive. So I was mentioning, in the English language, we use the word submissive in at least a couple of ways. And one way we use the word submission is to like submit your resume, like if you need to find a job, or you submit your credentials. So Queen Kunti in this particular section is submitting her consciousness to the Supreme Lord, giving an inventory of how she processed the very difficult situations in her life. This is also an anga of bhakti. It's called viknapti. Viknapti means submission. And it is, submission means to offer your own prayers to the Supreme Lord, to give a submission of your consciousness to the Supreme Lord. If you feel like you can't do that, then you can offer what's called stava. Stava means standard prayers in the scriptures. But also one of the powerful forms of bhakti is to offer your own prayers to the Supreme Lord, viknapti. Just like when you're in front of the deities at the, what do you call it? The Govinda's prayers in the morning. Govinda, and you may offer like a little, everyone's like sitting in front of the altar, you know, dear Lord. I never could think of anything, so I just look at the, I can't think of anything. Usually when I would go for Govinda prayers, I just go, oh, it's not working. because not so refined, not so purified, the mind doesn't think to offer anything. But actually, Vignapti means you're giving a submission of your consciousness. So in this section of Queen Kunti's prayers, she's giving a submission of the contents of her consciousness and how she processed the very difficult circumstances of her life. She first begins by listing all the difficult circumstances she went through. And then she speaks this particular verse, Vipada santu tashashrat. May these calamities come again and again. Now, how many people pray like this? You go up to the Lord and say, my dear Lord, I'm undergoing so many difficulties. May it happen again and again and again. I always, when I used to hear this prayer, I used to wonder, why she has to pray like this? It's a material world. Difficulties anyway will come again and again and again. No need to pray for it. But she is not actually praying for difficulties. She says that may these difficulties come again and again. Because Bhavato Dharshanam Yasha, because when there are difficulties, I can see you. Or I can remember you profoundly. And by remembering you, I no longer see, Apunar Bhava Darshanam, I no longer see this material existence. So the idea here is that when one is not able to remember the Lord, then what are you seeing? Then you're seeing the material existence. And you're being absorbed in that existence. And then from such absorption, you have to take birth again in that world. But if you're able to see the Supreme Lord, instead of just seeing what appears in front of the naked eye, but if you're able to see the Supreme Lord, then you no longer have to be, how you say, psychologically accosted by what appears to be the reality. You follow this point? The idea is that apparent reality is always distressful. This material world is not very nice. But if you're able to remember the Supreme Lord profoundly, then you're no longer seeing reality as it appears to be, but you're seeing a much more beautiful reality. You're seeing the reality that is orchestrated by the Supreme Lord for your upliftment. And when you're not able to see the Supreme Lord, all you see is a reality of injustice. This is usually the prominent mentality of conditioned consciousness. This something is unfair happening to me, isn't it? You always feel like there's something unfair is happening to me, and that's all you see. But if you're able to see the Supreme Lord, then you don't see an environment of injustice, but you see a beautiful environment orchestrated by the Supreme Lord for one's upliftment. So in this particular purport to this verse, Vipadasantuta Shashva, Srila Prabhupada mentions there very nicely toward the end that on an ontological level, the soul actually doesn't experience any suffering. There can be no calamity for the soul. Why can there be no calamity for the soul? What's the answer? Why is there no calamity for the soul? The soul is eternal and blissful. Yeah, that's the answer. What other answer do you have? It doesn't mix with material energy. It's in an ontologically different category than matter. So there can actually be no suffering for the spirit soul. Prabhupada makes this comment in the purport, which is very interesting. Just like when you're dreaming, Prabhupada says this also in the purport, when you're dreaming, you might dream that a tiger is eating you. So in the dream, you're like really freaking out. And then you might even start to scream externally. And your friend who is not dreaming, he's looking, this fellow is disturbing my sleep. Already I'm in the Brahmacharya ashram with so many guys, and then this guy has to start making so much noise in the night. So you give one slap, wake up. And then when he wakes up, he realizes that he's not suffering at all, actually. It was simply due to his absorption in a false reality that was causing the suffering. So Prabhupada comments that similarly for the soul, there can be no actual suffering. He's beyond time and space, so there is no question of anything gross actually happening to the soul and causing a calamitous situation. So what does the calamity do for the soul? It actually presents an opportunity to shatter his absorption in the temporary, which is very seductive. Material energy is very... seductive is a good word. It like seduces you. Just like if you ever have someone ever try to seduce you before, maybe you've tried to seduce someone before, you do your, something very charming, like move in a certain way, and like this. I don't want to get too vivid in the Bhagavatam class. But a good example is there, like when Maya tried to seduce Lord Brahma. She tried to seduce him, and it's described in that section of the CC that she was striking poses that would bewilder anyone. When Maya was trying to bewilder Haridas Thakur. And Haridas Thakur was just chanting Hare Krishna. And Maya was coming, and it says that she was striking all sorts of poses that would bewilder the mind of Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma has four heads, so he has a really strong intelligence. But the poses that Maya was striking could bewilder even Lord Brahma. We can't even imagine what those poses are. It doesn't take so much to bewilder us. Just one Pepsi is, happens to be around and no one's looking. That's enough to keep our conscience. It doesn't take so much to bewilder us. But for Lord Brahma, Maya, whatever she was doing, we don't even want to know. Just by thinking about it, you might fall down. If you try to think about it too deeply, what were those poses Maya was hitting? You'll become bewildered thinking about that. But Haridas Thakur was not bewildered by that. So Maya, this material world, has a way of seducing us to become more and more invested in her. Another good example that I often like to give is in the Matrix movie. Many of you have seen it. And I've given this example so many times in my classes that some people have even watched the Matrix just to see what I'm talking about. So maybe it's not always appropriate to give these examples. Anyway, but for the, how many have seen this movie, The Matrix, you've seen? So in the movie, when Morpheus is training up the new Bhakta, Neo, the Bhakta training program, then at one point, they're in the simulated Matrix, and Morpheus is trying to preach to him, and all of a sudden, the lady in the red dress walks by, you remember this, and Morpheus, or Neo becomes, like, bewildered. And so Morpheus is like, are you hearing me? Or were you looking at the lady in the red dress? And, Neo's like, well, like he gets bewildered, and then Morpheus is like, look again, and it's like an agent pointing a gun at his face. You remember this particular scene? It's a very enlightening scene, actually. Once you have some Christian conscious philosophy, you can justify anything. Anyway, so in this scene, he becomes, he's learning that matrix, the material energy, is very seductive, and it comes in apparent ways that are very attractive. And then after you get attracted, all of a sudden it's the agent pointing a gun at your face and you're dead. So the nature of the material reality is that it seduces the living entity to absorb herself or himself more and more into that energy. And the way she seduces is not just by coming as a lady in a red dress, but also by hatred, duality, you know. Just like I have one particular friend, new acquaintance, that he's very into the Black Lives Matter sort of thing. And he's so enraged by what's happening to black people that on his Facebook thing, he like posts something like 20 posts a day about like, you know, white supremacy and all these race issues. And he makes these really inflammatory statements just because he's so angry. This is another way the material energy seduces the living entity. You know, you become so identified, Black Lives Matter, and I have to stand up for that. And he just absorbs in hatred, actually. And you know, the irony of the thing, you become the very thing that you hate. So his consciousness becomes more and more filled with, you know, animosity and hatred. So in various ways, the material energy seduces the living entity. And so in this way, we're all seduced by Maya in one way or another. Yes, we're all in Maya. So then what does calamity do? Calamity helps to break that seduction. It helps us to break the absorption in Maya. And then when that is broken, one is able to think of the Supreme Lord. So Prabhupada comments in this purport that this is what calamity actually is doing. For the soul, there can be no actual suffering because he's in an ontologically different category. And therefore, what calamity is facilitating is his breaking of his absorption. In other words, nothing can harm the soul unless the soul harms himself. This is a statement of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta. I never used to appreciate it until I saw this purport of Prabhupada's. Nothing can harm the soul unless the soul harms himself. So how does the soul harm himself? He's in an ontologically different category than matter. So he can't be cut by weapons, burned by fire, withered by the wind, etc. So how can the soul hurt himself if he's in an ontologically different category than matter? What were you saying? Same thing. And by identify. Yeah, so the word that Lord Chaitanya uses for this is bahirmukha. Bahirmukha means externally orientated. That's how I like to often translate this word. It literally means outward facing. Bahir means like out or outward, and mukha means face. So bahirmukha means externally orientated. That means that when you look at reality, you only see what appears to be true. And you never see an underlying reality beyond that. This is called bahirmukha. So by bahirmukhatva, by this quality of being externally orientated, the soul causes harm to himself. When the actual reality is, no harm can actually come to him. Therefore, whatever suffering is happening to the soul is an opportunity to learn something and to break the contamination of bahirmukhatva. This is the basic contamination of conditional life. It says in the Bhagavatam, Ishara Petasha, the soul is Ishara Petasha, turned away from the Lord. Or Bahirmukha, he's turned outward, away from the Lord. And practically nothing can turn him towards the Lord. I often joke like this, you know, when we're turned away from the Lord and devotees are like trying to turn us back towards, you know, Kishore Kishore. But there's like this spring in our neck, you know. As soon as we're outside of devotee sangha, outside of the sangha of the Bhagavatam, then, you know, and isn't it? You like, the devotee's working so hard to turn us towards Krishna. And then as soon as we get outside, it's, and we're like totally fixed on Maya, like the, I'm getting this image of, you know, in the cars, they can put these little, what do you call it, like toys that like bobble their heads. There's this spring thing, you know? So like this, and devotees try to help us see a reality beyond the apparent reality, but we're stuck on apparent reality because of bahirmukha. Isharapetasha Vipario Ashmitahi, we're forgetful, Ashmitahi, of our actual spiritual nature. And Vipario, as such, we are absorbed in the opposite of what our nature is. As such, we are always experiencing fear. So dangerous situation presents an opportunity to break our bahirmukhatva, which is the main contamination of the soul. This is the root contamination, being turned away from God. And calamity helps to break that. So in Prabhupada's purport, he's saying that for a devotee, dangerous situations presents a wonderful opportunity. One should not allow dangerous situations, good suffering to go to waste. I heard this statement. One should not allow good suffering to go to waste. Isn't it? You suffer, but one should not allow good suffering to go to waste. What is meant by good suffering? Because it's teaching something that will break the external orientation towards reality and allow you to think of Krishna more deeply. Prabhupada also quotes this other very famous verse of the Bhagavatam, Tatenu Kampam Sukshamikshamana, which is a verse Prabhupada also says is the process of Bhakti Yoga. What is that process? That while eagerly awaiting the mercy of the Lord, Bhunjana Evatma Kritami Pakam, one tolerates whatever suffering is happening to them as a reaction to their own misdeeds. This is basically the beginning of spiritual consciousness, that whatever is happening to me is my fault. I have some role to play in that. I have some responsibility to play with in that, how the environment is coming at me. This is a very difficult thing to do and not so easy. That whatever, because reality in our state can be looked at in two ways, like conventional reality, what appears to be happening, and then something else that's beyond all of that. And what tends to happen is that we see according to what's actually happening to us because it's closer. We see conventionally. In other words, for example, I am not this body. Yes, I'm not this body. But I really do feel like this body. When I'm hungry, I really feel hungry. And I need to eat. It's not that I need to feed my body. I don't think like that. Do you think like that? When the body is hungry, you think, I need to feed my body. No, you think, I'm hungry like anything. I need to eat, you know? So that's because this conventional awareness is like that. It's very close to us. Whereas ontological awareness, like our philosophy, we're not the body in the spiritual world, it's abstract kind of knowledge. Before it's embodied, it's abstract and kind of external to us. You follow this point? Like your emotions, for example, are very close to you. So when it comes to looking at a situation according to your emotions or according to Shastra, which one usually gets the upper hand in your consideration? Probably the emotional life. Why does the emotional life get so much consideration? Because it's very close to you. You have direct perception of your emotions. And so you give that a very serious consideration in your processing what to do and how to interact in life. Whereas knowledge is external to you. Before you embody knowledge that is given in Bhagavad Gita, then it's very external to us. It's like exterior to us, and therefore we don't give it that much serious consideration. You follow this point? It's very difficult. Therefore, when, for example, this is just when someone dies and they're suffering the emotional content of dealing with the death of a family member, and you walk up to them and say, well, you know, they're not the body, right? And they're probably just, you know, just as the soul is changing bodies, it changes, or just as a person changes clothes, it changes bodies at death, and you don't have to worry about it, you know, nothing to cry about. Do you talk like that to someone? No. Why not? Because that knowledge, even if they know it, is external to what they're feeling, because we have yet to embody that knowledge. And therefore, when making a consideration about anything, there's always like the conventional consideration, like what's practical according to the circumstances, but then it's also the ontological consideration, what is the ultimate truth, which I cannot see with my naked eye, but which I've come to know about through hearing. So when interacting in this world, you have to make practical considerations, but you can't lose sight of the actual truth that underlines the appearances. But that's a very difficult thing to do if you're not embodying knowledge. If you don't actually embody self-realization, then you'd not be able to do that so easily. So here Prabhupada's quoting this verse, Tate Nukampam Sukshamikshmana, Bhunjana Evatma Kritami. The devotee considers that whatever is happening to him on a practical level, the actual truth behind that appearance is the Supreme Lord, who is guiding that activity for my purification. And therefore, he vagva puber vidadan namaste. Therefore, that devotee never becomes angry at the Lord. Or Prabhupada writes here in the purport, he never accuses the Lord, which is also a very difficult thing to do. Sometimes when the suffering is just a little bit, it's all right, but when you feel like the suffering is incessant, then you start to wonder, why is God doing this to me? Is there even a God? Maybe there's no Krishna. These sorts of things may come in the mind when you're immature. But the devotee never does. How is he able to avoid this? He has to give a lot of consideration to that which is external to him in the form of spiritual knowledge by hearing, shravanam. And then Prabhupada says, when a devotee lives in this way, his salvation is guaranteed. So this verse is basically giving the idea that suffering is an opportunity to think of Krishna in a deep way, in a way that is filled with feeling. But that will be possible only if you can seriously consider a truth that is outside of your own reference point. Which is the challenge of spiritual life. I've been telling this frog in the well story quite a bit these days. I like this story for some reason. I've told it here also, right? The frog in the well story, last time I told it. And the frog is there in the well, and so one swan comes to the top of the well, and the swan says, there's a big ocean, it's way bigger than your well. So the frog is like, no. There can't be nothing bigger than this well. Okay. I'll take it. Okay, it's bigger than my well. Is it like twice the size of my well? And the swan was like, no, it's much bigger than that. Is it five times the size of my well? And it's bigger than that. Is it 10 times the size of my well? No, it's much. Then the frog said, it doesn't exist. You're just pulling my leg. Because he's trying to understand the ocean from his own reference point. So it becomes impossible to understand what's actually happening. So similarly, we try to do that. We try to understand the truth from a finite reference point, and we become bewildered. So therefore, Shraddha is such an important item. Shraddha means you're willing to consider that there is a truth outside the prison of your well of ego, if you will, for the story. And that's very difficult. That means there's something beyond what I'm feeling. There's a truth beyond what I'm feeling, what I'm experiencing, which is informing my activities at the present moment. But that truth, because I don't embody it, because it doesn't exist inside my well, it's very hard to consider it seriously. So unless you have Shraddha, faith, and you're strengthening that Shraddha by constant hearing of this truth from the scriptures, then it's very hard to follow like this, where you consider dangerous situations, an opportunity for growth and so on. It's very hard to transcend that. But Prabhupada has written that this is a process of devotional service. So it requires a lot of profound faith and a lot of shravana to enlighten our emotional life and help us to actually feel this way when we're in challenging situations. So I'm going to end there and see if anyone wants to say anything or add anything. Yes, Subal Prabhu.
Yeah, thank you for the class, Jagannath Prabhu. I was just thinking something that you mentioned, that one should not waste some good suffering.
Not waste good suffering.
Yeah.
Take the lesson from it and grow.
Yeah, and one thinking, in the environment of, devotee sangha, one of the principles is, the loving care that is extended to us, and then we learn to extend to others. And when we think of devotee care, you think of, if you're in the position of trying to ensure that for the devotees, you want to make sure that there's a very smooth environment, for growth, like that there's a very favorable, growth environment, and to try to avoid, difficulties like that. And one thing that I was thinking as I hearing your class and these things are coming is that, in one sense, it doesn't make sense that we try to make sure that there is not going to be any difficulty, because difficulties are inbuilt in the whole, right, you know, material, right, situation. But what we learn and what we try to learn ourselves based on that, you know, you don't waste some, you know, nice suffering,
yeah,
nice suffering situation, is how we deal with, you know, difficulties that doesn't, that makes it, you know, in such a way that is such a great opportunity for growth, and to understand Krishna's hand and Krishna, you know, it's almost like our faith becomes even, you know, much more strengthening by, yeah, this situation. And I have, that's a comment, and I have a question from also something that you mentioned in the car, in the class, that, you know, our first tendency is to act emotionally towards one of the things that happens to us.
Right.
How, in your experience, you know, we deal with trying to, for ourselves and for others, you know, to switch, to help, you know, don't act emotionally, but try to act, you know, with the, from the perspective of, you know, shastras, the instructions, and, you know, transcendental knowledge.
Yeah, just to your comment also, I was in Chaupati with my godbrother, Gauranga Priya Prabhu. He's like my favorite person, one of my favorite people in the whole world. And they're in Chaupati. Many of you have either been in Chaupati or heard of Chaupati. It's like, you know, in terms of environment, probably as good as it gets for a brahmacharya ashram. But even there, so many devotees also leave and go to the grihastha ashram. It's when they struggle so much in the ashram. So I was talking with Gauranga Priya, and I mentioned this verse from Gita, Manashashtani Jnani Pakriti Stani Krashati, where Krishna says that all the conditioned souls in this world are struggling hard for happiness, Pakriti Stani Krashati, grappling hard for happiness because of the mind and the senses. So I was like, no matter how good the environment is, if they have mind and senses, there's going to be a problem. Anyone who has mind and senses, no matter how wonderful the environment is, there will be a problem. And we started laughing about that because it was like, yeah, and then we started sharing all the problems that we were seeing here, I was seeing here, and he was seeing there. So then in order to inform our emotional life, we need enlightenment. And for devotees, our enlightenment primarily comes from the Bhagavatam. Therefore, in my opinion, this is an opinion, the most important part of the morning program is the Bhagavatam class, actually. Because the Bhagavatam class is supposed to serve the functioning of enlightening our emotions. Our emotions are, again, they're so close to us that we will act impetuously. And if our emotions are benighted because of insufficient faith in the truth, then that will be our lot. And if our emotions are enlightened by the Bhagavatam, then our emotional life will reflect that automatically as well. So therefore, one of all the things to take really, the whole thing should be taken seriously, all of Krishna consciousness. But practically, especially in the beginning stages, the hearing process is the most important. And in fact, in Prabhupada's books, most of the time, if you see him writing about the 9 forms of devotional service, he says that of the 9 forms of devotional service, hearing is the most important. Most of the time, you can go and folio it if you don't believe me. In most of his writings, when he talks about the 9 devotional services together, whenever he does that, he says, of the 9, hearing is the most important. Hearing for us means the process by which we become enlightened. So that's like the most important thing, the Shravanam process, because the Shravanam is going to enlighten the emotional life and help us to act in a more enlightened way when the time comes. Now, so your question, in my personal experience, when dealing with challenges, it's very difficult. Even when you have knowledge, it is very difficult to transcend emotions, and it's very difficult to understand what is the proper thing to do, because the emotions create a sort of bewilderment. Krishna himself says this in the Bhagavad Gita: "Kim karma kim akarmeti kaveyo patramoita." That even for the kavis, kavi means a learned person. Kavi literally means poet. Poetic people have to be quite intelligent, creative. Even for the learned persons, it is very difficult. They are bewildered about what is to be done, what is not to be done. It's very difficult. So my personal experience tells me that even when you have knowledge, it's challenging. So one of the most important factors is someone that's probably more enlightened than you and who's detached from your situation to give the perspective that you may require for your dealing with a situation in a way that helps you to grow. Just like you may have this experience when someone comes to you with some problem. I've told this before. When someone comes to you with some problem, then you give such good advice. You ever had this experience when someone's coming to you with a problem and you start advising them, and when you're advising them, you start thinking, man, I'm speaking so beautifully. I never spoke so beautifully before in my life, you know? And you're telling them exactly what they should do, and you feel like very clear-headed. But when you're in that same situation, that same knowledge doesn't help you. Because the difference is you're attached to your own situation, and so that attachment causes like an eclipsing of proper knowledge. Whereas when a person's coming at you, you're detached from their situation, so you have a greater clarity. So it usually requires someone who's detached from your situation that's enlightened. And the last factor is that you trust them. Shraddha has to be there. You have to trust in this person's enlightenment, trust in their well wishes, and also trust in their detachment from your situation. Because if they're attached like you, they can't help you. Just like sometimes when you're suffering or you're in a particular situation, you just want to be validated. You don't want enlightenment. You want someone to validate you. And it feels good to be validated. Man, you're right. Thank you. Amen to that. You know, you feel really wonderful. But that isn't going to help you. You usually need someone who's detached, enlightened, and you trust them. You trust in their enlightenment, you trust in their detachment, and you trust in their well-wishing. And on a personal level, that's what's helped me in my own difficulties throughout the years in Krishna consciousness. And if you don't have that, then it's going to be rough. You can try to take shelter of the scripture, but you can understand it will be extremely challenging. Most likely you won't make it. That's my understanding.
I'm wondering if you can speak about the sufferings that come from living in an ashram, and living with the same people. Oftentimes we experience difficulties because we spend so much time with each other, and we're experiencing ego problems and purification together, and how to overcome these experiences.
I came across a new term called, the term is sadhu, which means friction with the sadhu. And the example that is given is just like when there are rocks with sharp edges and you put them in one spot, they're all banging into each other. But then as they're banging into each other, the sharp edges start to get smoothed out. So then this is a good thing. This sadhu friction is required. Because the basic problem is ego. And ego causes us to see everything from our own reference point and see ourselves as a sinner. But when you're existing with other entities around you, you're obliged to not look at yourself as a sinner, but to see that there are others there. And you become displaced from the center of your own consciousness when you have to do this. So it's a very healthy thing in general. Just on a practical level, there always has to be like some time for self, some alone time, but not too much. Too much alone time means you and Maya, for sure. But some alone time is required. And the basic obstacle that we're faced when living, not only with devotees, but just living with anyone for a long period of time, is that you tend to devalue them. The more you're associating with persons, you start to devalue them more. You start to see so many faults are there, so many idiosyncrasies that you don't like. This one smacks loudly when he chooses food. This one talks loudly. This one keeps passing air in the night, and I can't get proper rest. You start to see all these faults in them. And the more faults you see in a person, you devalue them more and more and more. Which means also that we don't understand what makes them valuable. What is it that makes a soul valuable? Ultimately, what makes any soul valuable is that they're part and parcel of Krishna. And the souls who are come to Krishna, in a lot of ways, are even more valuable. And we kind of have to
see that. Again, if we see only externally, then we'll become bewildered. There's no way out of that. So you have to have another criteria by which you're observing reality. Shastra Chakshu, the eye of scripture. And only if that becomes very strong, then, unless until that becomes very strong, the tendency to devalue entities, not only devotees, but any entities, becomes more prominent. And from that devaluing, you start to envy, start to become angry. Then you're saying, what are these people? They're useless people. I'm getting out of here like this. So for me, a lot of the answers can be reconciled in Shravana, strong. Because you need something that's informing your vision of the world. Otherwise, your emotions will inform your vision. And on an external level, being around anyone for too long, unless they're Krishna, is going to, you know, not going to be that nice. Hats off to all people who are married and they've been together for many, many years. It must be a great challenge. I often think about that, how challenging it must be to live with someone that close, you know, especially nowadays when it's like a nuclear sort of thing, a family, and it must be really painful, actually. And all the more so if you don't have something else enlightening your vision. So this is the basic challenge, just to devalue entities. That can be overcome by Shravana and seeing accordingly. You want to say something to this?
Hare Krishna. For Grihasthas and those who have the particularly difficult situation of working outside of an ashram, and they're spending eight hours a day working with very mundane people, and for instance here in the ashram,
I would say that sometimes that's good, yeah. And sometimes some devotees I know prefer it. I know many devotees who prefer that actually, and that they don't see it just as mundane work or working with mundane people. They see it as an opportunity for their own growth. And as far as the challenges of working outside, I think it's very challenging working inside ashram also. Per his particular analysis, you know. Sometimes you have to go out on Harinam and you're ridiculously tired, and then you have to lead the Harinam for an hour and a half, and the Mridanga player isn't playing properly, and the kartal player is getting off key, and everyone is looking at you funny, and you're looking at yourself funny. That could be psychologically demanding. Indeed, when we were in New York, we would often joke about this when we were on the Harinam party. Me and a lot of the Harinam residents, when we would go out, you know, you're out sitting in one spot all day, and the first 4 hours, you're like, you know, physically kind of tired. And you're looking at all these, New York, this is New York City, so it's summertime. Everyone's got their clothes off. And people are quite artsy in New York, and they look like, kind of like beautiful. I mean, you try to tell yourself, this is Maya. But that's exactly what happens. And I mean, when we were talking amongst each other, we would joke and we were talking like, sometimes it gets really demanding. So on a physical and psychological level, that's like really hard work. And many people don't appreciate it as hard work, but ask Ram Roy Prabhu, it's very challenging, you know? And every day having to go out. I remember when the first year I joined the ashram, I was responsible for the Harinam party. My first year, this might have been my third year. I started taking a Harinam party out once a week on Wednesday. 5 o'clock was the meetup time in the lobby, 5 o'clock. Everyone will start coming around 5:30. Gradually, and I used to get so frustrated. And then it would take us like, you know, so long to get out on Harinam. And then people would be doing their own thing on Harinam. One devotee, one time, we would be on Harinam, and he would see some fancy store. And he would start looking at the store and he has saffron on, you know? And I was like, Prabhu, this is not good preaching, you know? We're supposed to be detached from matter and everything. At least, you know, put on a show or something, you know, if you're not detached. So all I'm saying is that ashram work is hard work. For people who have to do the altar deity service is, you've not done deity service yet. I've done deity service, and you can ask these pujaris, it's very challenging work. Or Mother Rasika Mandri in Christian lunch every day. I don't know what time, she probably gets up at like 10 o'clock in the morning. She's like a warrior. She always reminds me of like, I was always into women heroines when I was growing up. And she kind of reminds me of that. And just she wakes up super early. Chancellor Japa comes for 4 o'clock to cook Christian lunch. That's some pretty demanding thing. So it's also hard work. That's all I'm saying. And so some devotees, I've, you know, weighing the pros and cons of both, some devotees sometimes prefer that situation also. It can also be unfavorable and unhealthy, undoubtedly, and that is kind of patent to all of us. But anyway, I'm just kind of adjusting some of the premises that it looks like you were setting up. Okay, now you can continue. If you have anything you want to say. Okay,
so post-adjustment on the premises that were set up, regarding a grihastha or someone who's working, they have this difficulty in that they must be absorbed in their activities because you must be productive. Okay. Whereas here, I can be absorbed in an activity, and that activity is very directly associated with serving Krishna, however difficult it may seem. Whereas someone who's in a position where they're working, they have to become absorbed in activities which actually, you have to, in a degree, you cannot fully not identify with it to be fully absorbed in those activities, to be productive, so to speak. Like when Arjuna was on the battlefield, I mean, he had to be fully absorbed in killing people, like, you see. And that's a pretty extreme example, but in that case, and they're not, and then they'll be thinking, the thought would be, when do I get to hear, even hearing, right? You know, they're basically praying to Krishna to be involved in devotional service. And that's, I'm almost uncomparable to being involved directly in devotional service and feeling this is difficult. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's how to deal with that, I guess.
Well, I'm not a grihastha that has such a situation, so I'm not the best person to ask. I can only speak theoretically. And theoretically speaking, from my understanding, people have different adhikar. So this famous verse is there in the Bhagavad Gita, karmani vadhikaraste mahapalesha kadachana makarampale. You know this verse. So Krishna in this section of the Gita is telling Arjuna that you have adhikara for karma. Now, of course, he's setting up a whole gradation of spiritual practices for purifying oneself. So in this particular section, he's qualifying Arjuna, you have this adhikara. You have adhikara for doing work, but you should do work in this particular understanding and mood. Mahapaleshu kadachana, the work is not for getting things in this world. The work is actually for getting something outer-worldly. Outer-worldly here means self-realization in context in which that verse appears. So you are to do the work because that's what you have adhikara for. Mahapaleshu kadachana, but you should not desire the fruits of that work because you desire another fruit, the fruit of self-realization. Ma karma palahe tubur, and never be the cause of that activity by desiring it, because it is desire that connects the soul's consciousness to the world of karma. If he doesn't desire it, then whatever is happening to him doesn't impact him. But once he desires something in the world, that desire connects him to the world of karma. So when doing the work, ma karma palahe tubur, never be the cause of that discussion about your now. You should fight with my devotional service. Have little faith. So I went to see the list like of the programs. First thing I looked for was the break. That was the first thing I was looking for. When I looked down, where is the break? Okay, I missed it. Where is the break? Break. Because it was literally a whole day program with so many speakers, you know. So then I was like, Prabhu, come over here. Where's the break at? You know, I was asking, oh, where break? Only lunch break is there. And that was like for an hour, you know. I was like, there ain't no break. How am I supposed to survive without a break? You know, I need a break from devotional service. So I would go in the morning time and I would go in the evening time because I wasn't able to take so much absorption. Of course, on the daytime, I was doing not always devotional service directly. I was sleeping sometimes, just walking around in the complex, thinking of bhakti, of course, and Krishna and all these things. So proportionate, and as your adhikara improves, as your faith advances in bhakti, then you can be proportionally absorbed. So for some people, they need engagement. Otherwise, they will become irresponsible. And if you go back to this Karmaneva Dikhariste verse, if you read Prabhupada's purport, I know when we think of purification of the booty, we think of purification as something like kind of like super mystical, like your booty is like Cheto Darpana Marjanam, and like you kind of imagine like stuff is coming, like, you know, like gook is coming off your intelligence, and I'm feeling purified. But actually, the purification is from whimsicality. If you go and study Prabhupada's purport, the purification is from, the word Prabhupada uses as capriciousness. And what does it mean to be capricious? I do what I want, when I want, how I want. So this is the, and that is a contamination of consciousness. So by working, you can be free from that contamination if you work in the spirit. I have some duty to do, and I perform that duty properly without desiring the fruits and without trying to connect myself to worldly things, but I'll become purified from this whimsicality. And I've seen the value of this in my recent experience, that this can also be very valuable. It's a reason why sometimes people are advised to get married, because by themselves, they'll become completely whimsical. Neither they'll absorb themselves in devotional service, because they don't have the adhikar based on a sufficient development of shraddha, and they're not doing anything practical. So then they become spoiled. They'll just become very irresponsible individuals. So at least on a theoretical level, that could be healthy for a particular individual when their adhikar is not deep enough. As they advance their shraddha, then along with the advancement of shraddha becomes a natural organic detachment from everything that's not Krishna. This is not required anymore. Because I will chant 64 rounds and study 4 hours of Bhagavatam a day and then go and do 6 hours of Harinam Kirtan. I'm ready. I'm digging it. I totally have a profound taste for it. But before such taste arises, if you try to do like that, then many devotees will have to suffer the consequences of trying to act outside their adhikar. And this is the meaning of the word niyamagraha from Rupa Goswami. What does niyamagraha mean? Niyamagraha means you're accepting some rules on a platform in which you're not yet situated. Niyamagraha, not being attentive to the rules, means you're not attentive to the rules for your particular adhikar. And you're trying to apply some rules on an adhikar that you're not on. And this niyamagraha is easy to become captured by because it's a little, how you say it? It's a little subtle. Granted, direct devotional activity is best if you can do it. Jish Shravanam Kirtanam, that is all that is required to please Krishna. That is best. So we want to move towards the ideal, but we can't be insensitive to our reality. There's the ideal and there's the reality. And at our present moment, there might be a gap between the two. So we can't be insensitive to the reality. And in the name of Utsahamayi, false enthusiasm. Yeah. Of course, you're newish. You've been around for 3 years. 3 years. So it's like a baby only. So when you get to be around 10 years, 15 years, you see how much change is there in your own self and consciousness. How old are you?
29.
So you're a little bit older, but still there's enough room for change. Change happens quite a bit as your realization improves and so on. So sometimes when you're newish, you think, charge! I know when I first joined, I used to think, man, I'm going back home to Godhead for sure. There's no doubt about that. You know, when I took initiation was so, it had no gravity. Like my initiation, I had no gravity in my consciousness. It was like, I'm going back to God. I was like completely without any gravity. And then after 5 years, I was like, some doubt came in my mind. I was like, probably I'm going back to Godhead. It's going to be challenging, but probably I'm going back. And then after 10 years, I was like, I don't know. If I'm going back to Godhead in this life, I'm still confident I'm going back to Godhead, but I was like, I don't know if I'm going to make it this life. Now, 13 years later, now I've been around 13 years only, and now I'm like, all right, I've just become satisfied with understanding that this life is meant for building momentum for my next life. Now, someone may say, well, that's because maybe I've committed aparad and I've lost faith or whatever the case may be. The idea that I'm making is that time has this power to change psychology. And the initial charge enthusiasm, you may start to become a little bit more sensitive to the reality that you're having to deal with, the sort of conditioned nature you have to deal with, and apply accordingly. If your faith is profound, then yeah, chant here, be ecstatic. But if you lack ruchi, then you may find that's a little challenging. It says someone's going to need some element for purifying them. All right, so they get some family. Family, you'll get purified. You get somewhere, you get purified. And then from that purification, you'll realize that this bhakti is only nice. Then you observe yourself like this. Yeah. Oh, Subha wants to say something on this. Maybe Subha wants to say something, then we'll close it out.
Chap. It's very nice discussions. Well, one thing that I've been thinking, almost to go to make a pitch for or to sell, you know, a concept, you know, like that, is the ashram experience. Sort of, you know, for our community, for our community of devotees, that it's in the ashram experience traditionally that we learn, you know, the skills and the tools for us to be able to navigate in the material world, sort of being able to figure it out, this Nishkam Karma Yoga that most of us, you know, is the adhikari that we have, you know, that we have to, we Karma Dieva Adhikaraste, that's our adhikari to most. So to figure it out, how to be able to work without attachment to the fruits, that's almost like a...
Krishna calls it the art of work. Yes. Yoga Karma Sukoshanam. This is exactly. The art of work.
So, you know, how do you learn that? You have to have an education that gives you tools to be able to perform your adhikari. Otherwise, it's not impossible, I would say, you know, but it's so difficult without it.
Yeah.
It's like trying to be a medical practitioner with no education. Yeah. You know,
I get this image of someone walking on a tightrope. You know, when you're walking on a tightrope, you have to keep your eyes straight and just walk forward. You can't look left or look right. But then that takes great. It's a great art to be able to do that. But then when you're trying to walk across a tightrope and someone's like, you know, like deliberately trying to distract you, then you look and you fall off. So it's hard to work and remain detached at the same time. It's like you're working and someone says, here's your check. And it's like $5,000. You know, you become like really ecstatic. Ching, ching. I remember from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. He used to get the dollar signs. Yeah, so anyway, just confirming your point. It's a great art. You need a lot of education to resist seduction. The material energy.
Yeah, so this ashram experience, basically, this is something just today you're appreciating Prabhupada's ISKCON, you know, the structure and the facility that give us a place for learning. And so the ashram experience is compulsory.
Yeah.
And if there is someone that, you know, is in the student age, the ashram experience should be facilitated for learning these skills. For some of us that are past the student life and we're already entangled in, you know, duties and families and this and that, the ashram experience is provided by these retreats and things like that, like you say, 24-hour, you know, you go to yatras and things like that. So then you get the experience, that experience of, you know, ashram. But in terms of a student, you know, a young person, it's almost like put it into the community, the importance of, the compulsory importance of gaining this type of, you know, of a instruction, education.
Right. Education. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.